Welcome back to the Batuta Advocate Radio Show. Another big guest. We're keeping this going, actually. We've been building momentum this year. We had New South Wales Premier Christopher Minns in the other day. We had Australian sex icon and actor heartthrob Angus Sampson. We had Willie Mason. We had Justin Horro. We've had a whole range of people.
Yeah, we haven't had the sex icon premier from South Australia, down from Adelaide, Malinowskis, yet. No. But maybe we'll get him.
Been casting a wide net. I always say that. And we always want to talk to everyone. We've previously spoken to the Queensland opposition leader, Mr. Crisafulli, and today we are speaking to the current Queensland Premier, Stephen Miles. Thank you for joining us.
G'day. Thanks for having me.
Now, you're joined with, for the listeners, it's myself, Clancy Overall, and Wendell Hussey here talking to the Premier, who was kind enough to give us this amount of time because there's a lot going on in Queensland, Greater Queensland. A lot of things that I guess would be demanding your attention right now. How far off are you from an election?
I think it's about 197 days or something, so it's not too far away.
Do you feel like you've got a lot of things you need to sort out before then?
I do, yeah. So I've been in the job about 4 months now. I'm trying to work through all of the concerns Queenslanders have raised with me and then set out a vision for the future come the election.
Now, we don't get to see too much of premiers out here in the corner of the Channel Country. So I want to start off with one of the big issues, one thing that I've noticed. Just mentioned a couple of premiers there, Clancy. We've got the typically good-looking, lean, tall AFL kind of build of Peter Malinowskis. Mm-hmm. We spoke to Chris Minns, Premier of New South Wales, Newcastle, Sydney and Wollongong. He's got more of that like nice hair, maybe a centre forward on local footballing team.
His aesthetic is 2 years sober. That's what he looks like.
You know? With the hair and everything, he's more of like a footballer. I'd say with Stephen, it's a bit more of a kind of quintessential Queenslander look. Like you look like you could pack into the second row of the Broncos there. And if anyone's seen your Instagram, it's probably fair to say the biggest pipes we've seen at a premier level around Australia. Bench press, what do you do on that?
Oh, bench. About 75.
Ooh, okay.
What are we talking, three sets of 10 there? Or that's not the one rep max?
Four sets of 8, maybe.
Okay. That's very impressive. I do want to know about your health routine. Obviously, you're traveling around. You've got a young family. There's a lot of stuff going on. How do you stay fit and healthy? Because you obviously look like you have a kind of a healthy balance in life there.
Well, I'm not ripped like Mally, as you say, and I'm certainly not 2 years sober like Minzy, but I just try to get to the gym as whenever I can. You know, it's important to stay healthy. It's also good for my mental health. You know,
there's a lot.
Who's the most stacked in Queensland Parliament? Would it be that Catter bloke, Danieletto? What's his name?
Demetto. Demetto is for his size. He's a little bloke with big muscles. De Brenny, our energy minister, I reckon. In fact, Demetto calls Mick arms for legs.
Okay.
Arms for legs.
Well, it's good to know there's some rapport between the parties. Now,
we end up in the gym together every now and then.
Yeah, of course, yes. you occasionally spot for a Catter Australia Party MP.
Yep.
Now, I want to ask, first and foremost, where did you grow up? What kind of Queenslander are we talking about? Because there's a few types.
Out of northern suburbs. So a suburb called Petrie, you know, pretty typical outer suburban working class place with a train station and a Woolies and a fire station, not a lot else.
I do know Petrie, and you can kind of keep travelling up there and you end up in the Daybros and the bush, right?
Yeah, it's on the way to Caboolture, yep.
So that would technically put you in Dutton country. What happened there? What was different in your life to the federal opposition leader?
Yeah, you know, it's funny, Dutton and I went to the same school. He's a bit older than me, and we do end up at events and stuff together because it's the same kind of community. We obviously had different upbringings and chose different directions. At one stage, we agreed on something. We were working together on it. And Peter said to me, now, Stephen, we're going to have to find enough things to still disagree on for our supporters. And I said, mate, I don't think that's going to be a problem.
Was that the Redcliffe Dolphins bid? Was that the one thing you agreed on?
That was the one thing we agreed on. We did a joint press conference.
I've seen that photograph. Now, I do want to ask you, do you support the Dolphins or the Bronx?
Oh, you know, it was really tough. I mean, the Dolphins were my QRL team, and I supported the bid, but after 20 years membership at the Broncos. They're still my number one team. The Dolphins have stolen my eldest though. Sam backs the Dolphins now, and he won't even come with me to Broncos games. So that's been a bit hard.
I think a lot of families are going through that right now. It's a rock and a hard place that you've put us in, Premier. Now, I want to ask, but what did you do before politics? That's another, we're going to ask the basic questions here because, look, you are 4 months into the role. We remember you as health minister. You got a lot of airtime there, as did every poor bugger that was in that role in every state throughout the pandemic. Brad Hazard, that's another name I never needed to know except for the pandemic ingrained it into my brain. What did you do before politics, before you ended up in the Queensland Labor Party and indeed in the role of Premier?
Well, before I was Health Minister, I was the Environment Minister, but before I was elected, I'd spent a bunch of time in around politics because I'd really decided that was where I could make the biggest difference. So trade unions and staffer roles, that kind of thing. Before that, like most people, I worked a bunch of jobs, cafes and stack and shelves at my local Woolies. And while I worked at the Transinfo call centre, you know, when you rate, before the internet, you'd ring and find out when to catch the bus. That was I like that job.
Yeah, well, that's when your kid doesn't come home from school on time because he's smoking bongs in Musgrave Park. That's the phone number you call, and we end up with the future premier on the other end.
What sort of a family did you grow up in, Stephen? Do you come from a working class family or
trade union family? Is that that's what I was going to ask? Is that in the blood?
Yeah, they weren't particularly political, but they were union members. My dad was a fitter at the Golden Circle Cannery, and he worked there for 33 years after leaving school at 14. Mum was a public servant. She worked at Workplace Health and Safety. So, pretty working class upbringing. My younger sister Kate, I was the first to go to university. She was the second. So my parents really worked really hard to try to get opportunities for us. And I reckon that's part of the story of Australia, isn't it? You know,
yeah,
generations
absolutely.
Working hard for their kids.
Finding your way into politics after school there, you mentioned you and your sister were the first to go to university in the family. Queensland's a lot more egalitarian than places like Sydney and Melbourne where it's, you know, it's a pretty shut club and you've got to be part of it if you want to move up the ranks. How did you find it as a kid from a working class family up in the suburbs moving down and trying to get into those inner circles of politics in Brisbane?
It certainly took some time, and you know, Petrie might not be that far away, but it is the commute to UQ was an hour and a half on a train to either the city or Toowong, or a bus, and then a bus out to St. Lucia. So that distance, you know, did make it harder. But I think that gave me a real passion for the kinds of people growing up in the kinds of places I was growing up, and that's what drew me to Labor and drew me to politics, really.
Now, we speak to all Queensland politicians about, obviously, one of the more defining eras in Queensland politics, which was the Sir Joe Bjelke-Petersen government. We released a documentary last year, The Batuta Advocate, on the fine cotton affair, which obviously high-profile members of the Sir Joe government and the Queensland Police Force at the time were involved in that great bin fire. I would like to know, you've got to be careful here because half of Queensland still really gets quite excited hearing the term Sir Joe, but what did your old man think of that era of Queensland politics as, you said, a union member, fitter and turner, probably not that close to building a skyscraper on the Gold Coast and probably didn't have 100,000 acres? Did he feel very represented and... Please tell us some of the kind things you might have said about the Premier.
We were certainly not fans of Sir Joe in our house. And, you know, the Fitzgerald Inquiry, I think I was in grade six, so it was really formative in, you know, I learnt about politics from watching the TV news, reading the afternoon telly Dad would bring home. They were pretty damning times on where Queensland had got to. And then I just remember the elation of Wayne Goss winning and taking over and just the pace of change that he brought, I found that pretty inspiring.
I want to talk to you about factions within Labor. This is for the listener. This isn't necessarily for us, but it changes in every state, and a lot of people don't understand it. You know what I mean? The Libs tend to get out of talking about factions because they say, oh, we've got a broad church and yada, yada, yada. You're allowed to be a conspiracist. You're allowed to be a Pentecostal. You're allowed to be, you know, a woman even. But
rarely, but yes.
Yeah. In the Labor Party, you very much do have this thing going on. And I'd like you to not only explain where you would arguably sit, but also what are the factions?
That's a great question. You're right. The factions are more institutionalized in Labor, although they exist in most organisations, I guess. We have three factions here in Queensland. Labor, I'm a member of the left. It's a bit like it's a big family, right? We don't always agree on everything, but when it comes to outwardly facing things, you're all united and on the same team. And I certainly find, you know, I've got good friends that can have an argument. In fact, we do, but at the end of the day, they're all good people with good values, and we're all on the same team.
Sort of arguments separate the left and the right factions, and what's the
third one?
We have a third faction in Queensland called Labor Unity, which is a smaller grouping.
Just wants everyone to get along. Is that what it is?
It's best I don't comment.
Yeah. But so what, okay, how would you...
My friends, okay.
So what are some of the things where the factions would differ?
Oftentimes it's not on the substance, it's on things like timing, you know, how much you can get done, how quickly. We've done a lot in this government that historically have been considered very progressive, and we've done them in a very deliberate way, but things like abortion law reform has been decades coming, voluntary assisted dying decades coming, and environmental protections that, you know, kicked off as Environment Minister, and we've been able to deliver. And it's not really, I mean, mostly they've been agreed with across the factions, but maybe the left has tended to agitate for more of it to happen more quickly. And I think that's a healthy tension to have within the party.
When you were at university, Stephen, you did a PhD that was titled Trade Union Renewal in Australia, Rebuilding Worker Involvement. What did you see were the main issues with the falling numbers in unions, and what do you think needs to be done to bring those levels back up again?
Well, I certainly wish my thesis had answered all of those questions and fixed all of those problems. It didn't. But what I think it pointed to was, while unions will often blame external and structural factors for what's happened there, you know, casualisation of work, the breakdown of employer sizes, and all of those things are factors, there is plenty of evidence of places where unions have been able to stay strong and continue to grow. And so my main argument was that unions, through their strategy and leadership and what they do and how they do it, are masters of their own destiny in some ways, could do more to attract more workers to them.
So, yeah, I mean, you hear stats quite often where, you know, the average union member in Australia would be a 37-year-old woman that sits behind a desk.
Or a nurse,
or someone holding a clipboard under fluoro lights, as opposed to, you know, the big burly blokes that you see marching on Labor Day. When it comes to the, you know, the union presence or the trade union movement, who are you dealing with the most?
Well, the public sector unions I see probably the most, including, you know, the nurses, the police union, the teachers union. But, you know, there's the retail sector is still highly unionised here in Queensland. I think that's a good example of where unions can continue to prosper in the modern economy.
On subject of unions, Stephen, I wanted to ask about this recent deal that has been made with the Best Practice Industry Conditions Agreement, which basically deals with construction workers on government sites. Talk us through that one and why you thought that was important.
So what we've done there is, when companies tender for our big projects, so this is more than $100 million, we don't want the key difference between the tenders to be how little they're paying their workers. So what we did was, we got the best practice EBAs from the big master contractors, and we said that we wanted everyone bidding for those big jobs to have at least that standard, so that they're not competing on who has the lowest EBA rates. And then we added in a bunch of policy matters that are priorities for us, like getting more apprentices trained, getting facilities for women, so female toilets, First Nations employment, that kind of thing. And that's really what our big picks are about. They're about making sure that government jobs are at the best practice standard. I don't think that's unreasonable.
I understand that you want, you know, best practice on government jobs, and you want the best employees coming through, and you want to get apprentices coming through as well. But in terms of making sure that companies aren't trying to beat each other on the price for what they're paying employees in tenders, is that about ensuring quality, or what is the main purpose of that?
Well, quality, safety, but also decent wages. You know, the workers that work on our sites, we want them to be well paid, to be able to afford to take care of their families, and you know, that's something that I believe in.
Then when it comes to things like teachers and nurses, I know health agreements in Queensland are also a lot better than places like New South Wales and Victoria. But when we look at construction sites, government construction sites, where blokes are getting $44 an hour as a fourth year apprentice and some nurses might be getting 50 or less, how do you value construction work at such a higher rate than things like teaching and nursing? And why is it important to be getting these blokes a pay rise and more picnic days and better conditions when it isn't the case for teachers and nurses?
Yeah, you're right. We do try to pay our teachers and nurses and AMBOs more than other states. We'll keep doing that. It's not always possible to just compare the hourly rate in construction with the hourly rate in a hospital. You know, our health workers have ongoing contracts of employment, where construction workers are much more transient. They don't necessarily know where they're going, whether they've got security of employment, job to job. We do need to attract people to those industries too. So I know, you know, there's plenty of sensational headlines to be made out of those conditions, but they are broadly the EBA conditions that you'd get on other construction work sites where they were being delivered by EBA companies. And what we know is that they're not just well paid, but they're safer workplaces, they're more apprentices, more trainees, more of the kinds of things that we want our projects to deliver.
I want to ask, how did you come to be the successor of Anastasia Palaszczuk? And look, we spoke about Sir Joe earlier, and I don't want to draw too many parallels, but she almost reached dictator status. And I say that as a compliment, but, you know, it's not often that a Labor premier could be flipping seats, some of those seats up the coast, you know, in retirement, Liberal voting boomer towns just flipped during the pandemic. There's a power vacuum. It's similar to Wayne Bennett leaving the Rabbitohs now, you know what I mean? They've got to organise for Mal Meninga to come down to fill that power vacuum, or else the players are going to run rampant. How did you come to be the successor? And are you a Mal Meninga or are you a Jason Demetriou?
Wayne's doing a great job at Redcliffe, so we're certainly grateful. Gratefully left the Rabbitohs. Like most things, there's a long story and a short story. I was health minister when COVID came, and I think that put me at the centre of a lot of government decision making that I might not have otherwise been, certainly that I wasn't when I was the environment minister. And then when the deputy position became available, I'd already been seen as the premier's kind of right-hand person because we'd done all that COVID work together. So that made sense. Turns out I wasn't as obvious a successor as I thought I was, though. There was a few other people who thought that they might be too. But in the end, I got here, and it's my job to prove to voters over the next 6 months that we're a new government and I'm the right leader.
So we go to the polls in end of October there. It does seem like COVID's kind of in the rearview mirror now. We can't slam the border shut on the filthy southerners and demonise them and tear up contracts for hotel quarantine that rile up the likes of Brad Hazzard and get all of the Queenslanders feeling good about themselves. What are the battleground issues leading into this election, in your opinion?
I get along really well with Brad. That's the when I became premier, he said that was the only thing he disagreed with me on. So I thought that wasn't bad for a Labor health minister versus a Liberal one. You're right, COVID isn't going to be an issue this election, but healthcare certainly is, and that's consistently one of the most important things for Queenslanders. I know that cost of living is what people are most concerned about. It's not necessarily something state governments can do a lot about. A lot of it is global factors and inflation and what the Australian government does, but we'll do what we can on that front. Housing, as you know, just these growing pains of the sheer number of people moving here makes it hard to build enough houses. So housing will be a focus. Education, community safety. I know we need to do more on community safety. So I think they're probably the top issues going into the election.
Can you tell me what's going on with the kids? Look, I don't want to buy into, you know, sensationalism either. But you are hearing horror stories, right? And some would argue, some who want to get torn to shreds, and the Batuta Advocate are happy to be that person, some would argue that maybe the kids are a little bit fucked up after COVID. You know, kids that probably were in violent households had to spend a lot more time in violent households during COVID. Schooling, education was disrupted. We wanted to believe that every single kid had an iPad at home and they could continue their learning through that, but that wasn't the case. There's a whole range of things that happened. You know, communities kind of have suffered economically as a result of COVID. What do you see as the lead cause of this youth crime wave spike? I mean, it's got to be more than the, you know, the fact that kids have figured out how to steal keyless cars.
Yeah, I reckon there's something in that. So there's a generation of kids who had a couple of years where schools would have picked up a problem and found a way to help them, and that didn't happen because there wasn't that contact. There was also a lot of other services that weren't delivered during that period of time too, so that, you know, services that in the past would have visited families at home couldn't for serious periods of time. And then you've got ice and alcohol, you know, not that long. When we first started drug testing young people, about 20% were on ice, and now it's closer to, or ice or another drug, now it's closer to 100%. And that's a big factor.
What do you mean, drug testing young offenders?
Yeah. Yeah. So that's,
so it's close to 100% are taking hard drugs.
Yeah. And I reckon if you looked at what their parents did, that's probably what their parents have done too. And it's pretty hard to imagine an upbringing like that. And then you layer in social media and just this trend of people boasting about beating people up or stealing cars online. And so it's kind of a whole heap of those kinds of social factors that have come together.
What are your plans to tackle this? I know I've heard that Labor has been in discussions with the CATA Australia MPs who have been banging this drum for years for bush relocations as opposed to prison. What are you talking? I know that the LNP are just saying remove detention as a last resort from the Youth Crime Act. They just bail, not jail, not bail. Basically, is what they're saying. People will vote on that because that's what, you know, people are desperate in some of these towns. What have Labor got in store to perhaps massage out some of these extreme social issues you've just mentioned?
Yeah, you're right. That's a good slogan, and oppositions can get by with good slogans. Governments need to do more than that. And so we have we're working on a whole comprehensive response. We've been trialing this new high visibility intensive policing, and it's proven really effective. So we're going to expand that. We're doing things like putting new helicopters in the air in Townsville to intercept stolen cars before they go on to commit other crimes. That's proven really effective. So we're going to look at where else we can do that. So really focusing in on what police can do to intervene as early as possible and prevent crime as soon as possible, as well as supporting victims and those intervention programs that I was talking about before, making sure schools and healthcare are doing their bit. That's a longer burn strategy, but we got to do both. We've got to deal with the current group and then make sure that we're not adding new young people to that group.
Yeah, the immediate things that need to be put in place are completely understandable, and that's, you know, the remedy. But in terms of the prevention, you mentioned there that schools and the health system need to be equipped. Are we looking at more rehabilitation services for young people? Are we looking at doing things that are a bit more holistic in terms of addressing those societal inequities that are affecting these young kids?
Yeah, more drug rehabilitation, better mental health services, more health services in schools. You know, most of these kids, their parents aren't going to harass a health service to get them an appointment. We need to get the health services to the schools. And then if you look even earlier, all these kids are born in our health services. They're born in Queensland Health Services. Mm. And I reckon the midwives can tell you each and every one that's going to struggle, each and every one that we should be putting extra services into. And, you know, we're working on this strategy called giving Queensland kids the best start in life, because if we can do that, we can give them a decent life and also stop them from ruining someone else's life.
I want to preface this next question by saying it's not on the teachers, and I totally understand that. But in terms of the school system, they obviously bear the brunt of a lot of this, and they start seeing those kids through the formative years and starting to see the kids acting up. And what I've heard anecdotally from a lot of teachers is there is so much in terms of paperwork and policy that does at times prevent them from having honest conversations with kids and stepping in and trying to help the kids almost as a mentor and an adult in their life. Do you see that there are any particular issues with kind of too much policy and over-regulation of actual school systems in allowing teachers to better help these kids?
Look, I have heard that feedback. Teachers have said that to me. The teachers' union has said that to me. And we're looking right now at what we can do to alleviate that, because if these kids don't have a responsible adult in their life, and mostly they don't, then the teacher is the best chance we've got. You know, you'd be astounded at the number of kids that get suspended in prep. You know, five-year-olds getting suspended. What chance has that kid got? And so longer term, health and education are the key. Of course, immediately we have to use the law and police and law enforcement to get on top of what's understandably a real concern for the community.
I want to talk now about you and your dreams and your hopes. How excited are you for the 2032 Olympics?
I'm going to say I was probably a bit more excited a couple of years ago than right now, but they tell me that's how these things always go, that there's the excitement when you get the rights and then there's all of the conjecture and arguments about what venue, where, which sport, when, how to get there, and then it tips back up towards closer to the games with maybe a little blip as we get into other games. So we've obviously got a games around the corner, and we'll all be celebrating what the Aussies achieve at both the Olympic and Paralympic Games. I'm still pretty excited. What it means for our state, you know, we did some research in key Olympic markets, and it was something like 3 or 4% of people had heard of Brisbane. And come the Olympics, that'll be, 80 or 90%. That's pretty huge for the city, if you're a business in the city, if you're selling your wares around the country. And I know some people in the region say, what's in it for us? But I think that also puts the whole state on the map. People who come here will come to visit the outback and the reef and the Daintree. And so there's lots of opportunities for the whole state.
Well, you are actually, it is a Queensland Olympics. I was just reading before that Country Bank Stadium are looking good to host the soccer. Or yep. Something like that. What I do want to ask is, again, Batuta Advocate's willing to be unpopular here, but once upon a time, there was a plan to have where James Packer's casino now stands in Barangaroo in Sydney. Once upon a time, that was supposed to be an entire sporting precinct from Darling Harbour into the ocean. They were going to have two stadiums, one that finished and sprawled over the actual harbour. That was going to be the whole setup. It was all going to be in town, walking distance from all of the major index train stations. Would have been great for football. In the years to come, it would have been a great little precinct. Now it's a giant casino that only rich high rollers from other countries can go to. Bob Carr, I think, was a premier at the time. At the last minute, changed it to the old Homebush Abattoir showgrounds and built the Olympics out there. Look, that went off without a hitch, yada, yada, yada. But to this day, sport suffers because it's a very hard place to get to from the west and the east of Sydney. For this reason, the Batuta Advocate formally endorses the Gabba precinct for a Brisbane Olympics. I'm already hearing that that's not the plan anymore. What are you up against there and what are the alternatives?
Yeah, so we looked really hard at the Gabba, and the first costing we got on that was just over $1 billion. That increased to $2.7 billion. It's a really difficult site. And then as we started to talk to AFL and cricket about what that meant for them for the 4 years of construction, they then wanted their own other dislocation stadiums. And so it ended up being that we'd have to build three new stadiums. That just wasn't very viable. I then got an independent committee to look at what the other options were and come up with something cheaper. And instead they came back with something more expensive, which really wasn't what I was
after.
Was
there a lot of swearing in your office that day when the independent review came back?
There was, yes. And it was a bit like turning up to a car dealer expecting to buy a BMW, deciding you can't afford it and asking for a Corolla and them telling you you had to have a Mercedes. We couldn't come at that. So we're still going to spend some money doing what we can at the Gabba, but it won't be a full knockdown rebuild like we'd planned. We do want to still get the connectivity. You know, we're building the big new transport interchange there with Cross River Rail and the Metro. We want to still deliver that connectivity. It'll still only be about 35,000 seats, which won't be what the AFL and cricket wanted into the future. But we'll still do most rounds of the AFL. And in terms of the precincts, I reckon we'll end up with, you know, Suncorp Stadium, Roma Street with the new arena, the urban renewal we'll see at Kurilpa. Then through South Bank, which is still a fantastic place, but is getting added to with things like Fish Lane. We want to connect that around all the way around to the Gabba and what we'll see there. And we have our own giant casino coming online soon too, just across that pedestrian bridge at Neville Bonner there.
So with that Gabba stuff, is that upgrading facilities, making it accessible, doing that sort of stuff? Because I think a lot of people agree that the Gabba does need some work done to it. It's no longer a modern day stadium.
Yeah, it's awful to get in and out of. And it's bloody hard to get out of and home to Mango Hill, I can tell you. But that'll get a lot easier when the train station's there. And then if we get the right pedestrian links, we've still got to do some work to get disabled access. That's probably going to be the hardest thing. But the rest of the place can get a refresh. We'll have probably $500 million available to upgrade it. And people who say that it one day needs to be knocked down and rebuilt, as far as I can tell, they never knocked the MCG down and rebuilt it. They just, you know, kept upgrading it.
I mean, Brisbane is lucky as it stands that all their major stadiums are in town, you know, from Suncorp to the Gabba.
Yeah, you're right. It sucks.
it truly does. Especially when Luke Coombs and the Matildas are playing on the same night and the trains go down. I want to ask, now we've spoken about Brisbane, you know, enough of that, about the regions. Traditionally, there's been two great earners in Queensland. Once upon a time, it was wool. That's probably not the case anymore, but agriculture still thrives. And, you know, you have a decentralised population voter base that you have to deal with. Hence why you're probably getting so much curry about the Olympics because, you know, majority of Queensland don't live in Brisbane. Mining and resources have also been, you know, historically a great employer. Only recently has it been a good job, a high-paying job, but it's always been there. What else is happening in the regions to keep young people employed? Something that kids can look to in their own community upon leaving school that isn't in the resources sector. I know the resources sector still has a big presence and still thrives in Queensland, but, you know, that won't last forever. And either, you know, laws will change globally. There'll be pressure put on Queensland to change the way things are going. We even saw it federally last election, you know. Three green seats in Brisbane and all the Teals coming through. Like, obviously, there's a political movement to transition to something. I don't think renewables, though, can employ as many people as the traditional fossil fuel sector. So what is there for the kids?
Well, first of all, you know, resources will obviously continue. You're right, there'll be a decline in thermal coal. 80% of Queensland's coal is coking coal for metal production, though, so that'll still continue for a period of time. But the critical minerals will take over a lot of that. You know, we have incredible mineral deposits that the world's going to need, so we're going to pursue that as well as.
And where are you seeing those deposits?
Mostly in the northwest, so you know, north and west of Mount Isa, places like Julia Creek.
Yep.
So we'll definitely develop that. You're right, there's not heaps of jobs in renewables, but there's a lot of jobs in the industries that can use those renewables. And so, you know, our task right now is to deliver green energy to those big energy-intensive users, like, you know, think the Boyne smelter. If we can get them onto renewables, then they'll have a long future. If we can't, then they'll be closed down by global markets. So that's really where our focus is on getting stored renewable energy for those heavy industries so that they can continue to be the big powerhouse employers of places like Gladstone and Rocky, Mackay, Townsville.
What are some of the ideas that you've brought personally to your job? Not necessarily on this, you know, this regional transition or not necessarily on the Olympics. As far as I know, you probably didn't even want the Olympics to begin with, but we won't go into that. I'm just saying every great leader has their own personal mission. And you'll see it in some. There was certainly that in Labor prime ministers of years gone by. You look at someone like George Bush. He was very much worried about viruses and the threat of viruses. And he, you know, America would have been in a lot of worse state during the pandemic if it wasn't for things that he'd personally advocated for. What is it that you bring with you as leader that's different? You know, you're part of a party. It's not really a broad church. There's three factions. You argue over things. You all vote on the same shit. What is it that is individual about you and what is something you actually care about as a person as opposed to reforming Labor leader?
For me, it is that energy transition.
That's it? That's your thing?
It is. Queensland's a really energy-intensive state, and if we can get renewables to those jobs, then we can protect the jobs. You know, I talked about growing up in Petrie and Dad working at a cannery. You know, I wouldn't have gone to university if my dad didn't have a good, secure industrial job. And that's what I, you know, aspire to for Queenslanders. And that's what will let them give their kids a better opportunity. And in the current world, that means getting renewable energy to their factory, to their processing plant, to their smelter, because that'll secure their jobs and attract other industries here too.
I know both parties often play a fairly straight bat to this, but I thought I'd ask anyway, and I'm curious to get your thoughts on it. Recent council elections in Brisbane saw a huge, huge spike in votes for the Greens. The federal election passed, saw three seats for the Greens. The Greens are doing quite well, obviously, around the country, but they're also doing particularly well in Queensland, which is what a lot of people down south who like to turn their nose up at Queenslanders can't wrap their head around. The fact that Queenslanders, you know, take issues as they come and they have different positions on things and they can't just all be put into one box.
The Greens, I mean, they also have the inherent urge to vote the exact opposite way as the rest of the country as well. So,
but the Greens are coming, and the Labor vote, primary vote, seems to be falling away progressively. At a certain point, it feels like there has to be a conversation between the Labor Party and the Greens about how to move forward together. Down in Tasmania, we just saw the Labor Party say, oh, we couldn't be fucked. We're not going to bother with the Greens. We don't actually have any interest in forming government. If it's with the Greens, you can just have it. Liberals, do what you want. Where do you see long-term, and how do you feel about Labor working more closely with the Greens rather than just shutting off from each other and basically drawing lines in the sand and fighting over it?
Look, it's really hard. Labor, because we aspire to be in government, we need to represent people in the city, people in the suburbs, and people in the regions. You can't win government without holding seats in the regions. And the Greens don't have to care about that. And so they can take positions that are popular in the inner city but don't represent the views of regional Queenslanders or even people in the suburbs. And so that means we end up disagreeing on a lot of stuff. They can say very populist things and never have to worry about delivering on them. So I don't know what the answer is. I know the problem you're pointing to, but it's not getting closer to them. I think it has to be bridging that divide. It has to be talking to young people in the inner city about how their interests in housing are similar to the concerns people in regions have about housing, and how we need solutions that will appeal to both of them, not just pithy slogans that might be popular in the city.
But those pithy slogans seem to have a lot of support because people look at it and, you know, whether it's through rational views or not, they see some merit in those arguments. Talking about a representative democracy, sure, if Labor want it, say they represent the regions much greater than the Greens do and the Greens are representing Brisbane, surely there can be some coming together as politicians and going, okay, what can we do to work together to actually achieve outcomes for people rather than just dismissing it? Because there are a significant number of people who vote for them.
I'd probably argue that they dismiss that too. I mean, they rely as much on brand differentiation from us. If you look at the way they've paired up, sided with the Liberals on Albo's housing bill, for example, you know, they're politicians at the end of the day. They run a political party at the end of the day, and they're going to do what's in their best interests. And that's very rarely working with us to get better outcomes.
Once upon a time, people forget this, before the LNP became one and those, you know, agrarian socialists from the land hopped into bed with those Reaganists from the city. You know, once upon a time, you walk into the Sir Joe's cabinet and say, hey, we're going to form a coalition with the Liberals, you just get laughed out as a soft cock. The Queensland Greens are clearly more palatable to the general population than that Bant-style Melbourne blue hair type. Where have they come from, and are there roots in Labor in this current, you know, Greenslander archetype, which, by the way, I can see them all getting re-elected federally?
Well, you're right. Some of them did come from Labor, and some of them are people who, you know, in a different world would be Labor people. The difference for me is Labor aspires to be in government. We're a party that believes that the best way you make a difference for the people you want to represent is by being in government, not necessarily by protest. And so for me, that's a major difference. Theory of change, and it's why, you know, the Greens don't appeal to me. They're not all like that, though. So, you know, Jono's pretty out there if you've had a look at him.
Yes, familiar with Jono's story. Now, you said you don't have the luxury to just, you know, appeal to West End and Rosalie, but I want to ask, is there any universe in your lifetime or the next where Labor starts winning back the bush? Like, I'm talking rural, outback Queensland. Oh. Where do you think you lost them? Because you talk to anyone over the age of, I don't know, 70, and they remember local Labor MPs. The last remnants is obviously the Katter, right? Like the Katter Party, Bob Katter himself, are the last remnants of Bush Labor. Where do you think you lost them? And where do you think you, and can you ever get them back?
Well, you talked about the decline of wool a little while ago, and there's a lot less shearers than there used to be. So, you know, the Bush changed a lot. The split, I think, played a role there as well. And the Nationals were, at the time, good at moving into that space. It's hard now to think, you know, I can't tell who killed who, the Liberals or the Nationals, because I can't see either of them in the LNP. But it's pretty hard to work out how to get back into those kinds of places. And you're right, we end up competing with, in the places where we did still exist, we end up competing with the Katters, places like Mount Isa. So we have a lot of seats in regional Queensland, though. You know, we're a government in Cairns and Townsville and Mackay and Rockhampton and Gladstone and White Bay, and that's a pretty big part of the state.
So what's the difference there? Who's voting for a Labor mayor and a far right LNP federal member?
Well, we see a lot of that, don't we? In the regions, what you end up with is state seats that are in the city centre, and then federal seats that take in much more rural parts. But there are also seats that in the not too distant past we held, like Kevin 07 won Flynn, and Herbert Leichhardt, seats that we can't seem to make inroads in. So also, I mean, we have that in the suburbs too. My seat, so we hold 9 seats in Moreton Bay, I think, and the federal Liberals hold the 3 federal seats, Longman, Dixon and Petrie.
Yeah, so the mortgage belt is kind of the two-tiered voter.
Have been, yeah.
Well, we've had you for long enough. Thank you for answering as best you could. Just lastly, President Joe Biden has today revealed that he's kind of thinking about dropping charges against a proud North Queenslander by the name of Julian Assange. Albanese's previously kind of gently lent support to Assange. Where do you stand as a proud Queenslander?
Look, I reckon it's gone on long enough, hasn't it? Like, sure, I get where they were coming from, where the Yanks were coming from at the time, but that's a long time ago. The bloke's been living in an embassy for years now. I'll let him come home.
There you have it. Thank you for talking to us, Premier Stephen Miles. We'll maybe reach out closer to the election.
We'll hopefully speak to you before the election. I just didn't want to know. Obviously, you don't want to think about, you know, the bad result or what might happen 26th of October. If it's a good result, what does it look like the next few days after that? Is it out to, you know, Moreton Island or Stratty, bit of a holiday, or
Gutter Bar?
I do love the Gutter Bar, but I don't think I'll get there. Now, if we win, it'll be straight back to work. If we lose, I suspect my phone will stop ringing pretty quickly.
Yeah. And then
we'll give you a call.
Then you get a job on Sky News or? We're kidding. Sure. All the best. Maybe we'll host a debate with you and Chris Afuli.
Yeah. Yeah. I love the podcast. Happy to come on whenever you'll have me.
Thanks, mate. Thanks,
Stephen. Appreciate it.
All the best.
Thank you. Have a great day.